Howdy! This episode, I chat with designer and filmmaker Robert Dulesky. We discuss his games Wars of Marcus Aurelius, Stilicho, and the recently released Fire and Stone, Siege of Vienna, as well as the role of narrative and some of the unique considerations that go into designing a siege game. So, what is the last great non-LEGO film you watched?
Oh, the last great non-LEGO film that I watched. That's a good question. There have been a couple. I recently watched a film called On the Silver Globe, which is a Polish science fiction film that was made in the started in the late 70s and finished in the late 80s after the director was basically kicked out of Poland. But it's a very strange, very, very unusual, very visually astonishing piece of work that's almost incoherent from a narrative point of view. But really enjoyed it. I also saw The Fabelmans for something a little more mainstream. I saw The Fabelmans, okay. The Spielberg autobiography, which I loved, which I thought was very good. So there we go, two kind of opposing poles of film experience, but both great.
Excellent. I think I've seen Fabelmans nearby, but the On the Silver Moon sounds really interesting. I also love when work has this imposed pause in the middle, and you have to pick it up later on. It's just like, it's almost impossible, right, to like maintain the thread between that. I think a lot of game designers would relate to that. Like, oh yeah, my project's been an ongoing half-decade odyssey. I'll just pick this up and see if I can continue the thread. No, it's great.
Well, there's always the question, right? When someone asks you how long you've been working on a game, it's like, I can give you the clean answer or I can give you the the messier answer. You know, I can tell you it was like, you know, 2 years, or I can tell you it's actually been eight in some way, you know, or whatever. Maybe not eight, but it's, you know, I'm often kind of shocked when I go back and look at when I actually started on something versus when it's finished, right? When it's delivered.
I know. There's a story about when Bob Dylan met Leonard Cohen, like on some European tour, and Dylan asks Leonard Cohen how long it took him to write Hallelujah, and I guess Cohen tells him it took him 2 years, when it actually took him like closer to like six or eight or something like that.
Right.
And then he asks Dylan, how long did it take you to write I&I? And he goes, 15 minutes. And it's like, probably took him about 15 minutes.
Right.
competing approaches, I guess, to work and that kind of work ethic. I mean, I would imagine, because you tend to do a lot of games on kind of Roman history, like a certain kind of later period Roman history, or at least your first two were. And I assume that that's out of a, you know, abundance of interest and some kind of familiarity with like that material and whatnot. So how much, I guess, do you feel like most of your design time is spent doing research for a game, or is it more spent on actual hard, like I'm ironing out mechanics and trying to kind of unravel what I want my game to actually be about and the story it's going to tell?
Well, that's a really interesting question. They're almost kind of equal in a sense. I mean, for me, the longest kind of periods are actually the research and then the play testing. And the actual design stuff is something I feel that can go quite a bit quicker on occasion. You know, I mean, it's a little bit of the kind of the, I don't know exactly what the rule is, but you know, it's some people call it like the, you know, the 80-20 rule or the 90-10 rule, you know, where you get 90% of the way and 10% of the time, and then that last 10% takes you 90% of the time. And I feel a little bit, you know, particularly when it comes to play testing and kind of that last period of refinement where you're really trying to chase down sort of you know, kind of troublesome things like balance or edge case kind of scenarios and all that kind of stuff, and really put the finishing touches on it. But just to loop back to your original question, with the three games that I've had published so far, they've all started out, they've all come out of research interests. They've come out of research interests and stuff that I've just pursued because I'm interested in it. And done a lot of reading and so forth, and then at some point it starts to look like a game to me. And then it turns into, it kind of morphs from research into design. So I've given you a very long-winded answer to, I think, what was a pretty simple question. But
I don't know about how simple it is to parse that, I think, sometimes, because when you are trying to get at the heart of what inspired you to work on something, that's actually much more difficult because it's the thing you've thought quite possibly the least about over the genesis of this project. That was like kind of an inkling, a feeling, or some sort of an epiphany. But then from there, it just, you keep kind of stacking and layering on top of it, right? Sort of like trying to uncover, I don't know, when I think about the intent for certain games that I've started work on, and then why I've abandoned them, it's usually just because in the shuffle of things, like, I couldn't find what I wanted to make out of it when I came back around to the idea, because I do a little bit more of a kind of a serpentine sort of like going across a lot of projects. The minute I hit a wall, I move over to the next one, and then I just keep winding back. And sometimes when you wind back to that one, you're like, I don't really know why I wanted to do this. I think I just thought I could, without, you know what I mean, rather that it was just a matter of like, oh, I know the exact mechanic or the exact type of system that would really complement this thematically well. But then I just wasn't interested enough to keep reading about that subject. I think this is going to sound like probably like slightly redundant after the last question, but I'm kind of wondering, so because your first two games, Wars of Marcus Aurelius and Stilicho, are solitaire games that center on these like very epic figures, but they're also transitional periods for Rome. And I'm kind of wondering what led you to tackle both of those for your first two designs. Do you feel like it was more about the figures or a little bit more about those transitional periods?
It was the transitional periods, I think. I mean, the figures are kind of inseparable from the periods, and so much of what we know about, you know, Roman history is tied to the people, the personas, you know, these emperor type figures or these leader type figures. I mean, you have that on the one end, and then you've got the sort of the archaeological record and so forth on the other side of things. And particularly in transitional periods, there's an attempt to kind of make sense out of sometimes what are two disparate or contradictory sets of data, you know. I mean, there's so much that we don't know about something like the Marcomannic Wars, which was the Marcus Aurelius scenario. I mean, and this was a, you know, a war that went on. There was a war and a plague and social upheaval and so forth. And you've got the emperor off fighting for 10 years and, you know, basically in, you know, the force of Germany. It's a huge, huge, huge thing. And there's not that much that's really recorded about it, you know, even in something like the Meditations, which is, you know, Marcus Aurelius's notes to himself, basically, you know, he makes only a few veiled references to it. And so much of what we know about that period comes from, you know, things like coins and archaeological finds of fortresses north of the Danube and, of course, the column of Marcus Aurelius. But I think that all of this is to say that it's the periods that really interested me. And it was trying to sort of, the games partly came out of my own attempt to sort of try to understand the history, I think. You know, to kind of, it's just like, you know, a game in some ways can be for a designer, can also be a kind of a machine to understand history a little bit. You kind of start saying, well, here's what I've learned and here's all the sort of dynamics. And are there a way that I can kind of put these, you know, these different elements and dynamics and bits of data that I have into a very kind of simple model and then try to understand how they all fit together? And can I learn something from that, you know? So that was certainly with the first game, that was kind of where it came from, I think. Trying to understand the timeline and some of the dynamics of what was going on with the Marcomannic Wars. And then I found a similar type of model fit for Stilicho as well, which I think is also a fascinating period.
Yeah, I could see how those historical periods would map onto, because you used your games have they resemble the States of Siege template, but one of the difference for me was the player perspective, I suppose. I guess like that kind of approach of like seeing like in Stilicho, like how as a player I can see that as I'm basically keeping back these threats, a tribe that is making these incursions into my territory can then be marshaled to use against another enemy. Like, oh, now I'm going to attack Constantine, right? And like this sense of, I felt like I had a little bit more agency in, you know, like something like Stillcove and like a typical like States of Siege game where I kind of feel like I'm just being hit in the face a lot by my own poor die rolls and then forced into a shame spiral of desperation where I will suddenly want to count a die that has landed squarely on the floor just because it had a favorable face you know, beaming up at me. How did you approach the narrative in your solitaire games that felt distinct, you think, from States of Siege?
How did I approach the narrative? Sorry.
How do you think your approach to the narrative in your solitaire games felt distinct from, say, other States of Siege?
Yeah, okay, it's an interesting question. I do like the States of Siege games, and I've played many of them. And I like a lot of the same things that other people like about them. I like the sort of the simplicity. I like the kind of there's a number of kind of technical and mechanical things I like about them, which I might get into in a minute. And then I have some of the same criticisms that other people have, you know, that sometimes they feel a little simplistic or that it feels like, you know, the dice have a kind of an outsized role, you know, so to speak, in determining the outcome of the game. For me, you know, the introduction of the cards and the kind of the CDG element was a big part of it. And I thought that that was a way of adding a lot of more player agency. And one of the things I tried to do with both of those games, it was whenever there's a kind of a random element, always to give the player a way of affecting that random element. So, you know, in Stilicho the way, or Wars of Marcus Aurelius, you know, you can use, during the battles, for example, you can discard cards to add to your die rolls, for example, or there's various cards that you can kind of hold in your hand and kind of play as you would in a CDG that kind of, you know, kind of tilt the conditions of victory in your favor, or so forth and so on. So it was really trying to add a kind of an extra dimension that way to both of those games. I think, you know, and this is a bit of a contradiction to what I was saying before, by kind of connecting both of those games to the perspective of the historical personas involved in each of them, Stilicho in the one case and Marcus Aurelius in the other, you know, I try to think a lot about decision space and what kind of decision space was available to both of those leaders, and to try to, you know, kind of cast the situation, cast the game as this, you know, look at it from the lens of what sort of decisions and options do they have available to them. As best as I could, you know, tell from the research and also what worked from a gaming perspective, and then try to put the player in those situations. So, you know, in one sense, yeah, that's kind of stepping away from, you know, my interest in the period as opposed to the person, but, you know, you've got to ground a game in something. And, you know, I think that CDGs worked really well with kind of creating an almost POV decision space. So in both of these, I found that was a good way to kind of, I guess, sort of give the game some focus, if that makes any sense. Rambling answer to a simple question.
That makes sense. I'm all here for long, rambling answers. I like a nice rambling answer.
You'll get a lot from me.
Because often I feel like I'm trying to, like, find it. Like, I don't start out responding to, like, oh, I have it. It's like always like, oh, I'm going to find it. And then every once in a while, like, an interview, it's like, I didn't find it. I looked in pursuit of it. I can see that in the... So first of all, I think it's a huge challenge probably working within that period to have CDG mechanics in part because your events, like, your history doesn't have... Like, you're pretty light on, like, the kind of information you would have, you know, compared to something like I'm covering the 1960, like, you know, American presidency, like, or the election leading up to the American president, like, you know, between Nixon and Kennedy. Like, there's tons of journalism, documentation, television, you know, debates, whatnot, that to draw from. But when we're talking about, like, these really old sources, like, well, he recorded some of his thoughts, I mean, in a journal of sorts. And then I've got a coin, you know, I've got some stuff that I saw, like, you know what I mean, like, immortalized on a wall, or here's something that somebody who didn't like him very much said about him. Like, you're drawing, like, a lot, trying to pull a lot more from a lot fewer sources, I feel like, sometimes. And it seems like way more of a challenge, I think, within that framework to try to, especially when you are trying to impart, like, that, what does this figure know, like, within this period? Do you think, like, how do you see that as being reflected in, you know, your So you're still co-design. You gave players a means to disrupt the dominoes being set up by your surge cards. You've got the encroaching armies, and there was that refinement to your system that you kind of created with having the handful of action cards that you could influence die rolls with, but also play them for their, you know, particular effects. Were a lot of these refinements to your system driven by a desire to create more player agency, would you say? Or was it more by a particular element of the period that you were hoping to highlight?
Oh, that's interesting. I think in the case of the surge mechanism, it was a mix of both. It was kind of a refinement to the mechanics of the game, and it was a way that I saw to kind of improve it from the earlier game, which was Marcus Aurelius. But in that game, it had come out partly from just an acknowledgement of, you know, for example, how good the Romans were at kind of divide and conquer diplomacy when it came to dealing with barbarian tribes. So the kind of mechanic kind of itself sort of sprang out of a desire to kind of model something that I was sort of seeing in the history, or that I think that was, you know, part of the generally accepted narrative of, you know, how the Romans conducted war and how they dealt with, you know, barbarian tribes and so forth. And it is something you kind of see a lot when you go back and you look at the history. There's a lot of, like, kind of trying to, in the period of Stilicho, which is around 400 BCE, the game really is sort of, I think, I can't remember where I started it. I think it was 405 or 406, up to a few years past Stilicho's assassination. But you see a lot of it just in how the Romans dealt with the Goths, for example, you know, kind of keeping them on tenterhooks a little bit. Hey, maybe we're going to hire you guys to kind of, you know, come and do some fighting for us, or maybe we're not, or maybe we're going to make Alaric a general, or maybe we're not. And sometimes he's fighting for the Romans, and sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's fighting for the Eastern Roman Empire, and sometimes he's fighting for the Western Roman Empire, and all this sort of thing. Or kind of dealing with the various usurpers that appeared during that period. There was a lot of kind of diplomacy is sort of as much a part of the Roman way of war at that time, I think, as actual kind of set piece battles, you know, which is a whole other topic. It's kind of a fascinating thing. And I think I'm getting a little bit off topic perhaps, but just to go back to the kind of the state of siege underlying model, I think one of the things I really like about that, and I think that it's a sort of a kind of a bit of an under-acknowledged bit of brilliance in that whole kind of design system, is the idea of this sort of amorphous front, that the front in these games is not something that's necessarily pinned down to, as I was saying before, like set piece battles on particular dates and times, but it's a kind of a push-pull feeling or push-pull series of what are probably undocumented skirmishes and minor battles and, you know, diplomatic coups and weather events and all sorts of things like this, yeah. You know what I mean? That kind of keep this front, you know, moving closer or further away from wherever it is that the people in charge want it to be. And I thought that was a terrific model for both of these historical periods when there's not a lot of information. You know, there's a few set piece battles that are known in Stilicho's time, you know, that have dates and times and so forth, but there must have been tons of other stuff going on. You know what I mean? There must have been, we know very little about what's going on in Gaul at that time, you know, between the Roman usurper forces and the Vandals, for example. And the Marcomannic Wars, you know, again, we have a few sort of set dates that are, you know, based on things that are marked on coins or appear on the column of Marcus Aurelius, but there must have been a ton of fights and skirmishes and so forth. So I thought that the state of siege system is very good at kind of capturing that dynamic. So there's a little bit of praise for that system, I think, that sometimes gets overlooked as being a little simplistic. I actually think it's kind of a sophisticated way of modeling certain types of unconventional warfare.
I think I'll be interested to hear why you think this is. But for me personally, the folks I talk to who are a little bit critical sometimes of like the States of Siege thing, it's more revealing about the types of things that they want to do in a game and how they don't want to feel. And I think that States of Siege makes people feel stressed out. And generally speaking, they don't want to feel that way for the entirety of a game. I mean, it's kind of interesting because I do mostly, I think, want to be kind of stressed out, because to me, I sort of equate that level of tension as being, that's just engagement. Like, I'm just, even if a game isn't fun sometimes, I mean, I care about being engaged more than I care about having fun, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe it's also that a lot of the films I like to watch are kind of unpleasant and sort of grueling to watch. So it's just like, like, you know, trying to explain to friends, like, I'm not watching Haneke's Piano Teacher for a second time because I want to have fun. Like, I just, you know what I mean? I was engaged. I was, interested, and I want to kind of come back to it. And I think that there's something about some of these set pieces that are probably better suited to a slow cook, you know what I mean? Kind of like this weird kind of like growing intense tension versus the kind of satisfaction or dopamine hit of the big landmark battle that then resolves itself, you know, and then it's like, yeah, ooh, I beat him and I won. But I don't know. What do you think, like, some of the reasons are for, like, that kind of, that there's a portion of that kind of war game audience that has these kind of issues with, the States of Siege games?
Well, you know, we all want different things from games, and I think that all games are kind of all games represent a kind of a model of mastery of one kind or another, which is that you know the very idea that you can abstract something as complex as a battle or an economic system or a political system, whatever, and, you know, into something that, you know, that you can control by pushing various levers, you know, which is what games are to a certain extent, particularly historical games. I mean, there's a kind of a level of control there that we assume exists that doesn't, I don't think, exists in the real world. So I think we're all kind of drawn to that a little bit, you know. We're all interested in the idea of, well, I put input in, and then what's the output, you know. And we have various degrees of comfort with what the relationship between those two things are. It's something interesting that I'm kind of experiencing a little bit right now with my new game with Fire and Stone Siege of Vienna, because this is a two-player game that's by virtue of how it's been published and marketed and so forth, is kind of reaching a bit of a broader audience than some of my earlier games. So I've got more, I would say, players coming into it from let's say more of a Euro background, or coming into it from a background where they haven't played war games maybe as much as with my other designs. And I'm finding the response are really kind of fascinating, for example, one comment was, well, we played this game for an hour and a half, and it was a tightly matched fight the whole way down, and, both sides were evenly matched, and we got down to the very end of the game, and the Ottomans were about to breach the walls, and the whole thing, it was the last turn, last card on the last turn, and it came down to one die roll. And this is so stupid. It shouldn't be decided by a die roll, you know? And it's like, it's so unfair, and someone should have won because they played better or whatever. And, you know, when I play war games, like, that's the thrilling end that we're all kind of looking for. You know what I mean? You get down to that roll and everybody's sweating, and you make it and you don't make it. And there's usually somebody kind of yells or shouts, and, you know, and then you want to set it up and play it again. And I think that, like, that actually is what I wanted that design to come down to. That to me, I was just like, oh my God, you played it perfectly. That sounds like the perfect, like the platonic version of that game to me. But some people hate it, you know, and some people really don't like that, that type of game or that type of game system. And hopefully I put in enough levers and choice, you know, opportunities for player decision and the ability to modify and affect roles and so forth, that it doesn't feel like it's just randomness. You know, you have to play very well to get to that point. So again, I don't think I'm necessarily answering your question. I'm kind of rambling around it.
I'm glad you brought up Fire and Stone, because my next question was kind of maneuvering us a little bit more to right. Present, right? I don't want you to think I was just going to talk about your older games. I wanted to ask, you know, for Fire and Stone, Siege of Vienna, you made this move from these two solitaire games that you had designed, where I could see, too, you were refining the system, you know what I mean, adding things to it. But then you switched to an asymmetric two-player game. I was wondering, did you find that more challenging? Was it invigorating to really shake up kind of your design approach for this?
It's harder because it's harder to get players to play test. You know, when you're doing a solitaire game, you can sit down and run, 10 games yourself in an afternoon or whatever, and you can send it out to 10 people and get, 10 people playing and so forth. And now all of a sudden you need 20 people to get that same amount of data. But it was kind of a conscious decision. I will probably at some point return to the solitaire design space, I suppose. I always wanted to do kind of three games, solitaire games on Rome, and I've got the kind of groundwork laid for another one. And it was sort of a conscious effort. You know, I suppose if I do this long enough, because my next game I'm working on now is like a 2-4 player game, and I suppose if I do this long enough, I'll eventually be up to like, 4-6 players or something like this, But I'm kind of taking it in steps, I suppose. There are different challenges, but for me they're less design challenges and more almost logistical challenges insofar as being able to kind of play test them and get enough information and data and kind of dealing with all the kind of stuff that you kind of get added as you add more players, I suppose.
I was curious too, because you know, one of the adjustments from designing for a solitaire game, you're accounting for one player's decisions within the framework of the system that you create in terms of like, how does it model history? What is the story that you're telling with this character? Mm-hmm. And then like also trying to figure out what kind of ahistorical shenanigans you want them to be able to get involved in and how much. And when you're dealing with more players, obviously now we are incorporating the decisions of two players, and then it kind of broadens how much trouble they're going to be able to get into, what kind of shenanigans they're going to be able to get into, and then how much, say, agency that they have versus how constrictive is the system you've set up to kind of enforce like a certain series of outcomes. A mild, tasteful, Sophoclean determinism to just keep everything on the rails, right? I could definitely see how that would really shake things up beyond just the logistics, but I never know how much to test a solitaire anything, like when I'm working on it. Like, I don't know, like, it would count if I play this thing 200 times. Like, I almost feel like it doesn't even matter if I play it 200 times. I need like real people, like meaning anyone else. Right. All I'm doing is like, it's like a Monte Carlo simulation for people who are bad at Excel. Like, I'm just playing it to see how it's going to shake out.
Yeah. I totally understand your point. And just having made a very similar, point with the difficulties and the importance of playtesting, because playtesting is incredibly important. I think there's tremendous value in playing your own, kind of both siding your own designs as well. You can detach yourself from it, I think, to a certain extent. I'm lucky in the sense that I've got a bad memory, so when I play two-handed anything, I can kind of like, I'm a bit of a goldfish, right? So I feel, look at these cards I've got on this other side. This is great. I'll have to come up with something for this. Part of playtesting and part of, from a design point of view is, you'll go in with very specific questions you want to answer. Like, what happens if I do this? Or what happens if a player does this, And you can kind of set up those parameters. And that's something that maybe is easier to do on your own sometimes if you're, unless you've got a very dedicated partner. One thing I'll say, this is a bit of a digression, is I understand kind of design partnerships a lot more than I used to, when you see kind of people that work with partners all the time. It's because, you've always got a playtester, someone who is obsessed with the game as you are, that if you want to go, hey, let's play it three more times and let's try this kind of thing. And I think sometimes when you work on your own, it's a little bit harder to get that unless you've got a dedicated group, which I'm fortunate to. I had some really wonderful playtesters from my local kind of game group and that are friends of mine that I kind of, but at a certain point you start to worry about, kind of burnout and, how many times can you get them to play your, I don't know if you found that as well, but it's just like,
oh yes,
we love you. We love your design, but for the love of God, can we just play anything else? today.
Yep.
You know. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating question, though. I do think there's a lot of value in really playing your own games and not worrying about that. But you do have to widen it out to playtesters to answer all sorts of questions you can't answer yourself. And I think one of them is that it's easy to get, you know, you don't want to, you're not designing a game for one person, you know, like one player. I don't mean like a solitary player, but I mean like one psychology, you know. Mm-hmm. This other group that I'm playing with, or this other, sorry, not this other group, but this other design that I'm working on right now, that's a, it's more of a kind of a mainstream, it's not a war game, it's more of a mainstream kind of 2 to 4 player. I don't, kind of a, like a hobby game, basically. We've got this one player who is, they're one of my daughter's friends, who is like this great game breaker because she's completely random and wild the way that she plays. So, you know, she's kind of like, there's a bit of almost like a betting element to this game. And she's just one of these, she comes over and pushes all the chips into the middle of the table kind of thing. Let's let the dice roll kind of stuff. And we're like, are you sure you really want to do that? And she's like, yes. And she's actually like this amazing playtester person because, you know, she's got a completely different sort of psychological approach to managing risk and so forth than I do or than some of the other players. And you have players like that, and you really want to see what does this do to my game, you know? And so just the kind of the diversity and range of psychologies and approaches and what people find fun and what they don't find fun and all this sort of thing, I think is tremendously important. And that's, I think that's really the thing you don't get when you just test yourself, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of the mathy stuff you can figure out yourself, you know what I mean? Or you can kind of change values or inputs or, you know, like with Siege of Vienna, I would just run lots of tests where like, what if I, as a player, I just bombard and I do nothing else, you know, I'm the Habsburgs and I do nothing else but bombard the whole game. Or what if I'm the Ottomans and I do nothing but mime the whole game or so forth and so on, you know what I mean? Or what if I'm the Habsburgs and I just sortie every chance I can. And that's great stuff you can do yourself and you can get a lot of data from without having to put players through it, right? And I think that's very useful and very valuable. But eventually it's got to go out into the wild and you've got to, you know, it's got to go to school on its own, right?
Right. I agree with the kind of hammer and tongs testing when you're really just stress testing certain aspects of the design. Mm-hmm. That's something that a designer should really do and not pollute other people's play with that. Contaminate. Like, I'm already, you know... Yeah. Wearing on my friend's patience, right? Like when I've called them in to like test something, but if I just do some kind of inane crap where I'm just basically like bombarding them repeatedly or something, and I just like, I'm just kind of giving them the worst possible play test I can possibly conjure up. But if I do that on my own, I can find that information while saving the more open play tests with testers that have fewer games under their belt or even no games under the belt. That's where we're trying to cultivate some of the information on like how are players basically able to read the game state? What do they think interpret this card or rule to mean? And those are like, that's more or less the data you're kind of collecting from those tests versus like the stress testing and things where, you know, sometimes I worry about too, like how over the course of playing something, there are things that I assume like every player is going to basically be jumping in at a point where it's basically a watermark far above the head of the new player, right? Because it's just, I have too much exposure to the game. I can't even see some parts of this idea anymore. And, or I'm assuming that certain things are more intuitive than they are just because of my familiarity with the subject matter rather than my familiarity with the game as a new player. And that can be like really challenging if you don't have enough, like really open testing, I think, decision. You know, I really wanted to ask because it is outside of your Roman scope, how you kind of came to this particular siege that you found. Like, what about this siege you found fascinating as a game design topic?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, one of my other historical interests or obsession might be too long. Or too strong of a term, but another period that I'm very interested in, or extended period, is the sort of the Habsburg and Venetian conflicts with the Ottoman Empire over the Mediterranean, from the period I'm most interested in, really, would probably be from the 15th century to the 17th century. And now this isn't directly connected with it. I mean, it is in the sense that it's sort of Habsburg and Ottoman conflict. But I've long been interested in, long been kind of entertaining a game that's sort of about the kind of the geopolitical and military struggle that takes place in the Mediterranean. The reason I mention this is that it's a lot of that hinges around some very important sieges, everything from the Siege of Constantinople, which kind of sort of starts this period, Siege of Rhodes, Siege of Malta, Candia, all these sort of amazing, very, very dramatic sieges that take place. So I had this sort of pre-existing interest in that. And then I just basically came across a book that I was reading, a book that looked interesting, and I started reading, which was about the Siege of Vienna. And I'd always heard about the Siege of, or known about the Siege of Vienna for a long time. I knew it's sort of historical kind of importance. I mean, there's two sieges, of course. I'm talking about the second, the 1683 siege. And then just sort of fell into this book and got very interested in the kind of the narrative military history of it. And that kind of tied in with the interest in the other stuff and also my general kind of interest in sort of siege technology and siege technique and siege warfare in the gunpowder era. And it just sort of exploded from there. And then I just, at that point is when I sort of started to think about this as a game. Just like, oh, is there a way to kind of start, honing all this down and trying to understand what I've been reading and understand how some of these mechanics, these sort of real world dynamics worked in gunpowder sieges. And Vienna is a kind of almost classic example in a lot of ways. It's a very kind of very dramatic example. And a lot of these dynamics are very kind of clear in terms of attacker and defender strategy and this sort of thing. So it started to look like a game to me, and that's sort of what drew me into it.
It's a beautiful game, might I add. I think Capstone and Donald Haggerty did like an amazing job with it. Just excellent.
Absolutely.
Work. Yeah. I'm kind of curious. I hope that it just to create the most stark contrast, like your prototype was the ugliest thing you could possibly manage to show. This isn't wood. It's just I saved some old teeth in a jar and we use these. Got like construction paper and stuff like that. Kind of. I was gonna say one of the standout elements for me in that game was the impact of the encounter deck, like on the siege, because it had this. Well, honestly, you should probably describe kind of how it works, but I thought that it was like a really neat thing to give this game like this innate replayability.
Oh, you mean with the kind of the, I mean, it's a CDG element, right? The sort of the, they're called strategy cards, which is a bit of a misnomer in a way, but the kind of the strategy cards that each side uses. Is that what you're talking about?
It was the encounter deck where there'd be like the one time effect that kind of sets the, I think it's called the encounter deck, but it was like these cards would have like a one-time sort of impact for the, it was like really limited. I'm trying to remember how many cards there were in that encounter deck.
It's not really an encounter deck.
Let's see what that's called.
So both sides have a strategy deck and then a tactic deck? Maybe
yes.
It's a tactics deck.
Yes, yeah, this was the tactics deck. I'm sorry.
No worries at all.
I play a few games.
It's no worries at all. It really, in some ways it really should be called maybe a battle deck. I mean, the whole game itself is really much more tactical than strategic. And someone commented about the game. They said it's not really a siege game. It's more of a breach game, which I actually think is kind of true, the scale that the game is set at. And that was really sort of what the scope of the game is really, it's really about breaching the walls as opposed to kind of the larger, kind of logistical and strategic elements that are involved in a siege. But the tactic cards, so those are individual battle cards that can have a tremendous impact on the outcome of the battles in the game. But you get a limited number, so you get to draw 5 at the beginning of the game. Each side has 10 or 12 if you get the special promo cards from Capstone by pre-ordering. So you draw a random set of five at the beginning, and that's all you have for the entire game. And you really have to sort of decide when you play them. And they're all very powerful, and they can have a really quite a big impact on the individual battles. There's even a kind of a thing to it where, you know, like you have to decide if you're going to play them, and the attacker plays first. If they sort of announce if they're going to play one, and then the defender can decide if they want to kind of play a card as well, and they're all sort of flipped up at the same time. But that idea partly came from War of the Ring, which is a great game, one of my favorites, where you have those battle cards that, you know, you dread it when your opponent is, you know, going to kind of drop one of those in front of you. So I was kind of inspired by that a little bit and wanted to bring that element into it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because to incorporate that in that element into a siege game, I think, you know, because the thing about War of the Ring is it's a chase game, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have a little bit more of a sprawl, and the feeling of a chase versus the feeling of a siege is so completely different. I think the interesting thing in, you know, kind of trying to design like a siege game for me would, like, I think what I would be really intimidated by is everybody has this established sense of like what the asymmetry should be kind of like, but from a player experience, it's like having a really compelling like defense experience, which I have no problem being the defender because it's just the sinking feeling to just, you know, continue over the entirety of the game. Whereas with the attacker, mm-hmm. I've seen some games where you feel, it's either relying on the sense of empowerment that player has to just beat on their opponent, or it's a little bit of they have their own tension with like the clock and like basically as time mm-hmm. is like running out, like, am I making enough gains to like keep forward this like impetuous kind of offense? So it's really interesting to like pull that from something that's counter. Cause I don't know, like when you're starting out with a design, I imagine it's sort of, I don't know, how much do you think you bring over from your filmmaking experience to like design?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, the dramatics are really important to me. That's something I have to really say, and I think that was part of what drew me to the subject material was the book that I'm talking about in particular, actually, which is Enemy at the Gate. It's Andrew Wheatcroft. I have it right here. I'll show it to the camera, but the listeners can't see it. It's a very, you know, it's narrative history, right? Like it's narrative military history. So it's very caught up in the dramatics of the situation. And that's something that really appeals to me. You know, as I was reading the book, I was like, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen now? And there's no way they're going to survive this. And, you know, your feelings of who's in the more desperate situation kind of switch back and forth as you're flipping page by page, you know. And that was something I really wanted to kind of get in the game, was this feeling that both sides have that they're both losing, you know, that you know, that it's impossible for both sides, you know, that for the Habsburgs, it feels inevitable that the Ottomans are eventually going to get up to the wall and get through. And then for the Habsburgs or for the Ottomans that you feel you just don't have enough time and there's no way you can do it. And that it comes down to these battles. And a lot of the design decisions I made in the battles, including the number of steps and so forth for these assaults and sorties and when cards are revealed and so forth, it was to try to add a little bit of psychology to it and keep them kind of interesting and dramatic, you know, and you flip over the cards and then there's still a die roll at the end. You have to go through a die roll after you've kind of revealed your cards to sort of, you know, in a sense, the dice sometimes determine the outcome of the battle, which is just this random element, which I personally think belongs in every war game. In an almost, this is a whole other topic. It's almost an ethical thing for me that, you shouldn't have in war or simulations of war, depictions of war, there should never be any kind of perfect strategy that always wins. There has to be a random element that can undo any plan almost, you know? I mean, you mitigate risk and you manage risk and you can, you know, have control over it and so forth, but there has to be a little bit of an X factor to the thing. So I try to incorporate that as well. And it's also dramatic. It's dramatic to roll dice in a game.
It is. I do it with great trepidation. I can feel the sweat from my palms coating these dice, which is definitely affecting the rolls in a negative way, which makes me quite cross.
Well, there's good dice and bad dice, as everyone knows, right?
Do you have like a little farm where you retire the bad dice? Because I certainly have. I have a spot where the bad dice go, and then they do not get called back from the retirement.
It's so
box.
Funny. I have a friend I play with, and he's got like this massive collection of dice, and he'll often go through several sets when we're playing different games. You know. And we tend to like, you know, he's one of my sort of gaming buddies, and we tend to like these games that have a lot of dice in them and stuff like that too. You know, Warriors of God and that sort of thing, where you end up just chucking handfuls of dice. I don't know. Do you know that game?
I do. Yeah, I definitely don't have. I'm not a. I have very mixed feelings about the incorporation of dice in games. But it's about my taste. I know it's my taste and not like the opinion, like what games should be or what they should include. But Warriors of God, so help me, nothing has made me want to flip a table quite as much as having random general. And I never really understand it. Maybe it's just because like a decade has passed since the last time I played it, but why the sudden absence of, you know, an English leader with my English army somewhere in France, suddenly those troops can just be scooped up by the next Frenchman to wander into the countryside.
Yeah.
It's just very perplexing to me and kind of goofy. But the die rolls in that game are, it's pretty wild. I think I like, I talk about this sometimes with Volko too. Like, I think uncertainty is important. Like, it's imperative in these types of games. But uncertainty and randomness aren't quite the same feeling to me. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's like uncertainty is within a certain parameter. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I need to know that the ceiling and the floor kind of adjust for particular situations. And even when we're talking about, there's certain aspects if I'm, you know, making a game about a given subject, maybe one side is just, they really do. I mean, they have the better troop quality. They have more of said troops. Their morale is higher. It's like, to me, if that is the case, like creating a game as though it's like a 50-50 proposition that they will win or lose every single battle is probably not a great idea. It might even be worth re-examining whether this game should be made at all. if one opponent just outclasses the other, that's why we kind of tend to see certain subject matter and certain conflicts covered more often. And I think part of the thing with ancient games or like games from like a certain kind of pre-antiquity type of thing is like part of the allure of that is that there's so limited information. It gives us a little bit more license as designers sometimes to create a system that allows, you know, multiple players to have like, compelling kind of objectives and things like where it's just like, well, we're not exactly certain like what went down in a particular battle, but you know, because all we've got is the coin commemorating one or what have you.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point. I mean, and that's a big, maybe a big part why I've stayed with ancients and kind of wandered into early modern kind of stuff. You know, because you do see this, you do see kind of stunning reversals and you do see odd things that, you know, kind of turn a battle in one direction or another. I mean, listen, if you've got like, you know, if you've got like vastly superior troops and, you know, 4-1, you know, concentration of, of a troop advantage, you're going to win, right? Most of the time, you know, and then Kanae comes along and you don't win, you know, and that's fascinating. And particularly for me anyways, particularly the scale of the games that I'm working on generally, or with the first two in particular, you know, you're talking about, you know, battles and skirmishes that are taking places off in deep dark forests or, you know, hundreds of miles away from where, you know, the kind of the sort of outside the purview and direct control of the player to a certain extent. You know, you don't have perfect knowledge. Maybe that's a better way of phrasing, but you don't have that kind of perfect knowledge. You know, there could be, you know, 5,000 guys coming over the hill, or there could be 15,000 guys coming over the hill. And those 15,000 guys could be, you know, hardened warriors, or they could be a rabble and you're not quite sure, you know what I mean? And you don't know, you may not even get a full sense of how many people you're fighting because of, you know, limited battlefield information and so forth and so on. So I think it plays more there. It's a very interesting question though, about what you described as, what did you say? It wasn't randomness, it was uncertainty. And I think that's a very, very good way of putting it. Uncertainty versus randomness. I like that a lot. I'm going to steal that if that's okay.
Take it.
it's probably a better way of explaining what I think I was after, which I feel that in, you know, part of what happens in Vienna is that Siege of Vienna, you know, is that this uncertainty plays a very big part, because you see it in accounts of the sieges, you know, or of the kind of the many battles that kind of made up a larger siege. You know, you've got one side that's got, you know, 150,000 people and another side that's got 15,000 people, right? And then the difference, of course, is the people with 15,000 people have actually built this machine that's designed to, you know, reduce the effectiveness of that 150,000 people down, right? And it's basically, you know, by the time you get into gunpowder sieges, it's essentially like an architectural machine that's designed to chew them up and slow them down so that a relief army can show up. And then a lot of it, you know, a lot of the effectiveness kind of shifts from battles to, you know, how can you defeat the machine, you know, through mining or through, you know, bombardment or artillery or all this sort of thing. So it's a kind of a different period of warfare. And I think it raises a different set of questions maybe than some of the more maneuver-based or kind of set-piece battle-based games that I think a lot of us are more used to maybe. And that was something I was really trying to get at with that game.
It's really fascinating because you're trying to like kind of hit this grace note on engineer being basically something that's engineered for abstinence, right? Like this fortification is just to keep you out. GTFO, you know what I mean? Stay out type of thing. And it's interesting because sometimes, especially in a lot of war games about sieges, it's laid out in the same way that a field battle would be laid out, like in terms of what we see. Like, it'd be interesting, and I just foresee this being abused by some sort of Kickstarter with a mound of useless plastic being created, but it'd be interesting to see that kind of a siege game take place in a way where you really don't know. It's almost like the, you know, sort of like the midway board where you've got like this little barrier in the center, but the idea of like, I don't even know how bad things are on the other side of the wall. Like, I've got a sense of what I'm inflicting, you know, and I think there's plague over there. I think there's like, they're starving in there, but all I know is how much time is spreading. And like, I'm on the clock. Like that idea that you wouldn't know what's going on the other side of the walls seems like it could create like a different kind of tension than one we typically, the way we kind of manufacture tension, right, within those siege games. And I think your game actually strikes like it does really kind of capitalize on that to some extent, because even though it's like laid out, there's a sense of the respective decks, there's a little bit more of this like kind of double blind, like I'm dealing with my own things right now, you know.
Yeah, and I tried to get that with the troop cards too. So for those that haven't played the game, the troops in the game are represented by cards, not by chits or counters or miniatures or anything. And you don't know going into a fight, you don't know, like into an assault or a sortie, you don't know what troops your opponent is playing until the cards are flipped up. And that's partly to kind of get this idea of, you don't know what's on the other side of the fortification. You know, are we going to hit the the veteran troops or the elites or is it janissaries coming over or is it auxiliaries coming over, sort of thing? And how many of them? Well, you'll know how many there are, but you don't know what the quality is. And also when you're killing them too, the troops that are at the end of a fight that are kind of killed and taken out of the fight it's random and it's hidden information. So you don't know. You can win a fight, but you don't necessarily know how much damage you've inflicted on the troops of the other side. And that was really kind of important as well, because you don't necessarily have that information, you know, when you, you know, it's a fog of war, very much, and particularly at that time too, right? Like you're not, you don't have anywhere near the information you have in a modern kind of conflict. So that was a really important part to kind of get in the game as well. You know, they've got, you know, you've got three cards that are going to be turned up by your opponent. You don't know if they're going to be, in this game, the troop values kind of range from 1 to 3, and you don't know if your opponent's going to turn up 3 threes or 3 ones. And if it's 3 ones, you might have just wasted your best troops to take down, you know, very weak troops, and then on your next fight, you don't have anybody strong left. Or you might have miscalculated, you know, and sent in some weaker troops against a full force that the other side is playing against you. This is partly why there's no solo mode for this game. It's interesting. A lot of people have asked me about a solitaire mode, and even Clay, the publisher, asked for it. And like, well, you've done all these solitaire games. You should be able to come up with a solitaire mode for this. I'm like, I can't figure it out. I don't know how to do it. And I don't want to do a solitaire mode for this. This is exact opposite. You know, it's supposed to be, this is a game that to me really relies on player psychology. And there's a bluffing element almost to it, you know. You don't know what you're going to get hit with. And to me, that's really kind of crucial.
It is a little strange how often there's a sense of like, well, you designed this two-player game. Like, clearly you could just give me half of it and then it's solitaire. It's like, then, like, you as the player should have no problem two-handing it then. If it is that easy, right? Like, if it's... Because I think in actuality, it just feels like I'm going to be designing a second game now using... The added constraint of all the same pieces to conjure up a different game.
That's very much the case, I think. And I know that, you know, other, you know, some companies do a very good job with this. I think, you know, GMT has got a pretty elaborate system of, they often include a kind of a fairly elaborate bot system and so forth, but I just can never figure those out. I have to be fully honest. I'm not good with flowcharts. I'm sure they're easy. I'm sure they're great, but I just tend to kind of two-hand it. And like I say, I've got the memory of a goldfish, so I can kind of go from one side to the other and kind of forget, you know, what I'm playing against, if there's cards involved or hidden information. But I mean, there's a lot of pleasure. You can take a lot of enjoyment from playing a game both sides, like a game that's designed for two players and playing it on your own and playing both sides, even if it's not, you know. You're not really competing against yourself, you know what I mean? But you're kind of understanding how the design works and you're learning a bit about the game itself, and you're kind of, I think there can be a lot of pleasure in that. And I think it's almost a kind of a, it's not that it's under-discussed, but I think as war gamers, it's something we're very familiar with, you know? Like, I've probably played most of my good war games more by myself than I have with other people. You know, like, holy crap, I've actually, like, four-handed soloed Here I Stand, you know, like, that's like, that was insane, you know, trying to do that. But I got a lot of pleasure out of it. It was great learning that system and sort of seeing how it worked and the creativity went into it and the design and the kind of the history that's unfolding and all this sort of thing. It's a very different sort of pleasure, I think, than playing it competitively with people. But you know, it's still fun to do.
It's got the vibe of, I think video game audiences are more familiar with it probably than most hobby gamers, but I think it's a little bit more an exploratory vibe. It's like a exploration, the historical tourism that Vocal likes to talk about, than satisfying the itch of competitive play. Like, I don't really care that my left hand is more competitive than my right hand, regardless of what the battle at hand is. And honestly, if you're playing like Here I Stand multi-handed, like, there's, you just have a hunger to play Here I Stand. clearly. You're just trying to, like, I just need to get this thing on the table. I got that 500th anniversary version. I haven't cracked the shrink on it. You know, it's been sitting on a shelf since pandemic. Like, I get that. I totally understand that. I have, like, two separate friends who are always talking about how this is going to be the summer or this is going to be the winter. I'm going to get this off the shelf. We're gonna play the anniversary edition. It's like,
yeah,
maybe. We'll see. I guess my last question was going to be, do you have a project that you're currently working on that's kind of next on the docket that you're able to talk about?
I have a few, as we all do, right? It's like racing cockroaches, I think, sometimes. I mean, that sounds a little gross, but bear with me for a sec. You know, you line up these guys at the starting line, and then one wanders off and turns around and walks back across the start line, and then one falls off the table and the cat eats it, and maybe one makes it to the end of the table and crosses the finish line, and I've got a bunch of those kind of out right now. Few things to get a little more specific. I'm working on actually this sort of like, it's more of a kind of a hobby game. Like I guess what you would say, like, I don't know what to call it, like a normal game, like a not more game, like a regular people game, I guess, in a sense. It's like right now the form it's taking is kind of, it's like a medieval monster hunting game that's based around marginalia and the artwork that monks would draw in the margins of illuminated manuscripts, which is another kind of great interest of mine. So that's something else that kind of came out of a sort of an aesthetic interest and kind of like, is there a way that I can, spend more time looking at these images, kind of thing, and is there a game we can make out of that? So that's something I'm kind of exploring right now, and I'm kind of pretty actively developing, and then a bunch of other kind of stuff in the sort of the war game category that I'm working on. I've been sort of playing with the design based around, as I mentioned before, some of the Ottoman, Habsburg, Venetian conflicts in the Mediterranean, which I just think is just an incredibly, incredibly interesting period of history and kind of sphere of politics and war and economics and all sorts of stuff, and then maybe we'll see if Siege of Vienna is successful. Maybe we'll do some more games like that, more of these sort of siege games in different periods. You know, it might be fun to do one about Alesia or lots of other kind of gunpowder sieges that are interesting too. So we'll see.
Our thanks to Robert Dolesky. Music provided by Telenovela, and you can find their tunes on Bandcamp. Off to a world to which I'll never belong. You can't be strong.